healthcare is probably the only thing you shop for when you're unconscious, where you make these big, someone makes a big decision for you that's going to have huge financial implications for your life. But, you know, especially in the case of emergency room billing.
I'm Dan Diamond. This is Pulse Check, and that was Vox's Sarah Cliff, who's been working on a detailed series about the problems with hospital billing for more than a year. Her latest story on Zuckerberg General Hospital in San Francisco was widely shared. And on this episode, we talk about that article, what she's learned from her series, and why hospital billing is so screwed up. You'll hear my conversation with Sarah in a moment, but first a reminder that if you like Pulse Check, you can rate us, review us, share the episodes with a friend. Just search for Politico's Pulse Check on your favorite podcast app. And you can send suggestions to me. I'm at ddiamond@politico.com by email. And with that, let's get to my conversation with Sarah. Sarah Cliff, senior policy correspondent and host of the Impact podcast at Vox. Welcome to Pulse Check.
Thank you for having me.
I appreciate you coming, especially because you had to crutch in to this podcast. I've seen people pursue stories aggressively before. I've never actually gone to the hospital to get...
You know, you got to do what you got to do to get the story.
Did that help you with your hospital billing stories, being a hospital patient?
It did not, but it made me more... I think every time you interact with the healthcare system, it makes you more empathetic to how challenging it can be to be a patient in our system.
So let's set the scene for your billing stories. You've been working on these hospital bills for a year and a half, two years?
Yeah, just about a year and a half.
Your podcast, The Impact, launched with an episode on the $629 Band-Aid.
That is true.
You had a story go viral this month on Zuckerberg General Hospital in San Francisco. We'll talk about that and what they're doing with billing that's so weird and unusual. Why did you decide to start this project?
So it started with the Band-Aid that you mentioned. So all of this started with a reader who sent me a bill. And he said, I took my daughter to the emergency room. She's 1 year old. I was clipping her fingernails. Blood started spurting everywhere. I freaked out. I took her to the emergency room. They said, it's fine. You're just a nervous new parent. Put a Band-Aid on the finger. Sent them home. And then he gets this bill for $629. And his question to me was, why is this Band-Aid from the emergency room so expensive? And my answer was, I don't know, but I want to find out, which is often my answer in journalism. And so I started digging into emergency room billing and the fees of going to the emergency room. And it just felt so much bigger than that one story. It's such a common way that we interact with our healthcare system, but it's one where the billing can be very opaque. So I, you know, realized the thing I wanted to understand was, you know, how much does it cost to go to the emergency room? And really the only way you can understand that, because those prices are secret, are by looking at lots of emergency room bills. So that is essentially what I started doing.
They used to be secret. There has been an effort recently to make them less secret, which we will get to. But this idea that patients don't know what they're going to have to pay, that does cause major problems for people trying to balance their budget, who show up with an emergency and then get the second emergency of the financial crisis that hits them.
Yeah. No, I mean, it can be a huge financial hit. And I think the thing that is so frustrating and difficult is these decisions that maybe you're making, maybe someone in an ambulance is making for you to go to hospital A or hospital B that are a few miles apart could have huge different financial consequences because they're charging really different prices or one employs out of doctors that aren't in network with your health insurance. So we're making all these decisions pretty blindly. And they're, you know, decisions looking back, we're like, oh, if I went to the other hospital, everything would have been fine, but they're decisions we just don't have the information to make at the point we're making them.
Or aren't priorities. When you're having a heart attack, you don't say, take me to the hospital covered by Cigna.
Right. Or, you know, I wrote about one guy who was attacked in downtown Austin. Was a bystander called an ambulance. He was brought to the hospital unconscious. Like, healthcare is probably the only thing you shop for when you're unconscious, where you make these big, someone makes a big decision for you that's going to have huge financial implications for your life. But, you know, especially in the case of emergency room billing, those decisions, you know, aren't always made by you. You're not always conscious when the decision is being made.
What is the root cause here? Is it that the healthcare industry in America is so fragmented, there isn't a single price setter in the government like there are in other countries? Is it some other reason that you've uncovered in your reporting?
I think that's a big part of it. The fact that there's no standardization to these fees, you know, creates a market where hospitals can really do whatever they want. You know, I think there's some bounds, you know, if they get criticized for it, if enough patients start going somewhere else because they hear the hospital, you know, a certain billing practices. But, you know, there's a, I have found in my series, there's a pretty, you know, high bar for something to, you know, be considered a billing practice a hospital won't take on.
What is that red line? Like, how far does it go?
You know, we're seeing right now the Zuckerberg Hospital in San Francisco is exploring changing its policies around out-of-network billing, but they have not changed anything yet. So, you know, that might be one. Being out-of-network with all private insurance might be a bar. You know, I've seen some bills reversed.
And just to translate that for everyone who might not know what out-of-network might mean.
Is not having contracts with the insurance companies in your area so that when patients with private insurance come into an emergency room, the insurance will pay an amount the insurance feels appropriate, and then the hospital will bill them for a much bigger amount that they feel they are owed for their services rendered. You know, I've seen some bills reversed in my series, hospitals that will charge you for waiting in their for the waiting room, where, you know, you decide not to seek service there eventually, you leave, and then you get a bill for the fact you entered the emergency room. I've seen bills reversed. I haven't seen their policies changed. So, the bar is pretty high for and varies a lot from hospital to hospital. I think the other thing that enables this is just the total lack of transparency. The fact that we can't see, you know, every emergency room is charging a facility fee for your visit, and those facility fees are just secret. You can't know what they are until you see them on your bill.
And when you say facility fee, this is essentially the fee that's covering all the things that the hospital is potentially doing, right?
Sort of, because there'll be other things on your bill too. But I think of it as like the cover charge for like coming in, for using the room. You know, usually they're going to bill you for like the medications they give you for, you know, you usually get a professional fee from the doctor who sees you. But it essentially, when it is described to me by folks in hospital billing, it's, you know, the fee for keeping the lights on, for keeping this place open 24/7.
Sure. It's the privilege of going to that hospital and keeping its operations running.
Yes.
The sunk cost that went into the hospital.
Yes. Yes. So that is, but it varies so much from hospital to hospital that I have a lot of questions about how they are set and, you know, what is that relationship between the overhead of running an emergency room and the fee that a patient is getting charged?
I have those questions, too, because as you know, when we first met, I was a hospital consultant, essentially, at the advisory board company.
Yes. And I was writing the Pulse newsletter.
It's funny. This either speaks to how few jobs there actually are in Washington, D.C., or how limited
some our repertoires are.
Yeah. Yeah. I look forward to hosting Vox the Impact in 15 years. But the idea that hospitals are essentially in control of setting their own prices based on numbers that sometimes they're mm-hmm. pulling out of the air to justify other financial decisions that they might be making. That high hospital emergency department fee might be related to the fact that the hospital is also trying to subsidize a major expansion,
right,
or has brought on a very expensive cardiac surgeon. I mean, these decisions that are impacting patients are not transparent, in part because the number of people who have that information tends to be a very small number of hospital financial people and executives.
Yeah. And I mean, if you look at the case of, you know, Zuckerberg, San Francisco General, their prices are set by the city, which just regularly does, you know, a 6 or 7% increase each year. This, you know, there was one 2008 report where it starts and then that becomes the baseline. And then you just kind of increase every year because that's what you've done the year prior. And then all of a sudden you end up with, you know, some of the highest emergency room prices in the city of San Francisco. And then you try and like pull back, like, how did we get here? And then you end up at this like 2008 baseline report that, you don't even know how much it reflects the costs, you know, as they are 10 years later.
Let's talk about how you get to these stories. That $629 Band-Aid, that came from a patient and a reader. Mm-hmm. You have since collected more patient billing stories.
Yes.
Is this now a situation where it's a slow news day? You're going to flip through your file of crazy bills and find a story?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, so we have a database that almost has 2,000 bills in it. I've read about 1,400 of them. And it actually kind of is like that. You know, when I have like a slow afternoon, it's like I just go into the database and start reading bills. And, you know, it's not, most of them are not going to generate a story. You know, there's 2,000 of them. I'm not going to write 2,000 bills. And it literally is just me reading all of these bills. But, you know, I'm looking for something interesting, something surprising, some kind of pattern to a hospital's billing practices. And, you know, I would say I probably spend 2 to 3 hours each week reading bills and just looking for something, you know, that I find confusing or interesting and then reporting about it.
Can I outsource my like paying of bills and reading of bills to you? Because that is the least favorite part of my week. And it sounds like you really developed a specialty.
Once I get through my 2000, you can be 2001.
Did you pick the Zuckerberg story? Honestly, did you pick any of it because of the name Zuckerberg? And Mark Zuckerberg is a controversial figure. You've written other hospital billing stories before. Here comes one branded after the Facebook guy.
You know, I didn't. You know, most of the bills, actually, I have some bills from before 2015 when it's just San Francisco General. You know, the reason I picked it is just the billing practices were so bizarre. They were like no other hospital I've looked at in the country where, and I kept seeing the same thing. And, you know, the first two or three times I saw it, I thought, oh, that's like a weird thing that an emergency room was out of network. Must be some weird dispute between that health insurance plan and the hospital, and just kind of moved on. After I got to the point where there are like a half dozen of them, I was like, okay, something bizarre is going on in this hospital. And this is something I started noticing maybe like 4 or 5 months ago. So it was kind of a slow burn of a story where, you know, I wasn't going to write anything until I saw that it was kind of this habitual practice. You know, I certainly drew more attention to the story that had happened to me, named after the founder of Facebook, who's under fire for a whole host of other things. But it's not a new practice by any means after his donation. It seems to go back, you know, well before he made this big donation to them.
And this is the story called a $20,243 bike crash. Zuckerberg Hospital's aggressive tactics leave patients with big bills. And your subhead was, I spent a year writing about ER bills. Zuckerberg, San Francisco General, has the most surprising billing practices I've seen. That's a very grabby subhead. We can't write those at Politico. No. But if listeners want to see that story, there will be a link in the show notes. I want to move from the stories that you've written to the impact on policy and on the industry, especially because hospitals aren't here to defend themselves. And I want to make sure that we're understanding the bigger argument here. Has there been any change from either the stories in terms of policies that hospitals are adopting or in D.C. legislation that might be advancing?
Yeah. So I think, you know, between the work I've been doing, you know, I'd also give Kaiser Health News and NPR a lot of credit. They've been running this Bill of the Month Club that kind of has a similar mission to it, to take patient bills and tell interesting stories about the healthcare system. I think we've seen a lot of increased interest, particularly in these out-of-network billing issues. And the place where there's been the most focus is out-of-network providers working at in-network emergency rooms. So, you know, one of the stories I wrote, it's actually about that guy in Austin who wakes up in a downtown hospital. His face is all mangled from this attack. And one of the first things he does is gets on his phone and looks up whether the hospital's in network. He thinks, phew, I'm covered, which also is just a crazy situation that the first thing you do when you wake up in a trauma is look up network status. But then it turns out the emergency surgeon who's going to operate on his jaw is not in network, and he ends up with an $8,000 bill from that surgeon. And those are the types of situations that you're now starting to see legislation on Capitol Hill to address. So there's one bill from Senator Cassidy of Louisiana, a Republican, another one from Senator Hassan from New Hampshire, who, you know, she said her bill has been inspired by the reporting that I've been doing. Both of them, you know, meant to take patients out of this situation. They have different policy remedies for it. But the goal is, you know, if there is a place where the hospital and the insurer can't come to an agreement on price, that shouldn't fall on the patient. You know, it should be up to those two bodies that have much more financial means to kind of haggle out a price and figure it out. You know, we just saw San Francisco is exploring some hearings around the network policies at Zuckerberg San Francisco General. The hospital is actually run by the city, so it'd be kind of up to them to kind of think through how they want to handle that. And then, you know, on a smaller level, but big for the patients that we've been covering, you know, we've seen about $45,000 in medical bills reversed after our stories have run. So, you know, I haven't heard of hospitals changing their policies yet, but we know the hospitals are aware. You know, a few days after I announced that I was working on this project, the American Hospital Association sent out a bit of a warning to all of its members saying, hey, Vox is doing this investigation. You know, please make sure you have your billing practices in line, that you have familiarity with them. So I think they are certainly aware of the increased scrutiny from myself and from others that they're under.
It is a badge of honor as a reporter when you yes. can get the association to respond in any way. Well, let's talk a little bit more about that legislation, because we yeah. have a lot of listeners who either are on Capitol Hill or work with the Hill. Hassan's bill, Maggie mm-hmm. Hassan, the New Hampshire Democrat, this idea of arbitration.
Yeah.
And you interviewed her, and the idea that she laid out was sort of like in baseball when the sides sit down and negotiate on a contract. Is there any precedent for that when it comes mm-hmm. to resolving hospital billing?
So New York has a law like that right now. That kind of seems to be the model that a lot of people are gravitating towards. And the way it works, I understand it is called baseball-style arbitration. I know nothing about baseball salaries, despite everything I know about healthcare. But what happens, you know, in the situation where the insurance company, the hospital, haven't agreed on the price, they have to go before an impartial arbiter and basically each submit what they think is the fairest price to be paid for the service that was rendered. This arbiter is then going to pick one of those two prices. So it is supposed to create an incentive where, you know, the hospital isn't going to, you know, go too high, the doctor or the insurer won't go too low, that they want the arbiter to pick their price as the fairest. New York has a law like this that, you know, is pretty favorably viewed by policy wonks. New Jersey just implemented one within the past year. So that certainly seems to be gaining a lot of traction in states as they are trying to deal with this. You know, unfortunately, there are a lot of plans that are regulated at the federal level and not the state level. So the state plans in New York, New Jersey, elsewhere can't touch a lot of health insurance. And that's where kind of these plans from Hassan, from Cassidy, come in to deal with these federally regulated plans.
I'm curious if you've been taking the temperature on Capitol Hill for any of this legislation advancing. And I ask because I think this is pretty well known. I remember reading an Ezra Klein Wonk blog post that may be familiar to you, Ezra and Wonk blog.
I've heard of it.
But on the vanishingly small amount of legislation that actually becomes law.
Yeah.
So Hassan, Cassidy, they can put these bills out there,
right.
but if they're not picked up by the committees, if there isn't enough of a consensus, they might as well not be doing much. Do you have any sense whether this Congress is going to be moving on any of those bills?
So that is an excellent question. It's still kind of early in this Congress to tell. I think, you know, I have reasons for pessimism and optimism. You know, the reasons why I would think it would pass is it's a place where you see bipartisan interests. So, you know, the approaches that Cassidy and Hassan are taking to this, they're a bit different, but not different in like the normal partisan breakdown. Like Hassan wants to use baseball style arbitration. Cassidy, you know, actually wants to use Medicare rates as a peg and use that as the way to figure out the payment. But they're working, it's the two sides working towards like a similar policy goal that, you know, most Americans would agree is a good one. You know, the reason for pessimism of anything moving is, you know, these bills have been out there for a few months. You haven't really seen much happening. I feel like, I mean, you do a lot of coverage of Congress. I feel like there's a lot of interest in talking about Medicare for All and fleshing out a vision on that. There's a lot of interest. You know, my colleague Dylan Scott was writing about all these plans on drug pricing. So it's unclear. I think if something like this were to pass, it probably wouldn't be as a standalone bill. It'd probably be kind of brought on to some other healthcare package. So maybe like a drug pricing bill that also has this provision. I think, you know, I think it would struggle to move through on its own.
One thing that I'm watching, the new head of the Senate Finance Committee, Chuck Grassley, who about a decade ago was responsible in large part for some of the most significant changes in how hospitals were regulated. He mm-hmm. advanced these community benefit regulations on what hospitals had to disclose and what their obligations would be if they wanted to keep their tax-exempt status. After a number of years when he was on the Senate Judiciary Committee, leading that committee, he is back leading the Finance Committee, and his staff is probably annoyed with me for bugging them on hospital questions for the past number of years. But I'd written about tax-exempt mm-hmm. hospitals, and now that he is back over this committee, I've wanted to know, is he going to do anything on some of the hospital issues that have cropped up? I would include billing
right.
as one of those big things. So even though there might not be a lot of attention in the moment as drug mm-hmm. pricing and Medicare for All overshadow, what Grassley chooses to do, I think, will be an incredible measuring stick of the interest in Congress.
Yeah. And I think that's an important, you know, it also relates a little bit. This is going a little far afield. But how I think about 2020 is, you know, some of the questions we ask in policy is like, what do they actually want to do? But I think another key question that doesn't get asked as much is like, where does it fall on the priority list? And I think that's like one of these issues with surprise billing. Is it seems pretty clear most people think this is a bad way to run the healthcare system. The question is, like, does that become enough of a priority, or is the priority like drug pricing or Medicare for All or so many healthcare things and non-healthcare things that you could, you know, put your staff to task working on.
So I was out with a friend who works with hospitals, and I mentioned I'd be sitting down with you for this podcast. And just as you said, people realize that this is a problem, that there is some bipartisan anger around it. My friend, who's read your pieces on hospital billing, said that the Zuckerberg piece, quote, was basically overkill. How many really expensive bills do you need to say that healthcare is really expensive and that the uninsured gets screwed more than everyone else? So I am curious, how many stories do need to be written on this topic? Don't we understand at this point that billing is messed up?
I mean, we understand it, but it keeps happening and causing, you know, perilous financial ruin for a lot of Americans. So, you know, I think just because it's a problem that's been written about before doesn't make it less of a problem. And I think that's one of the things, you know, I've really learned from the reporting that I've been doing on this is, yes, people are aware, but when you write about these things, like a hospital that has a $6,000 charge for sitting in an emergency room, that's still surprising and kind of astounding. So, you know, I think as long as this is an issue, you know, that Americans are struggling with, it's an issue that is worthy of coverage. You know, just because a problem has been around for a long time, I don't think that makes it any less of a problem.
So are you planning on just writing about it until the problem is solved?
You know, at some point, I personally will need to stop writing about emergency room bills. So I don't know how long. We haven't quite decided how long we're going to keep writing this project. But I think it is a worthy endeavor for journalists. You know, I'm not the first journalist to write about healthcare prices in America. I hope I will not be the last.
Well, maybe you will be the last. Maybe the problem will be solved. Well, we'll never have to write about it.
Okay, then we'll find other things to write about.
So these hospital billing stories, where do they fit then in all of the other healthcare issues and policy issues you've been tracking? Where do you place them in your own personal like constellation of priorities?
So I think they kind of fit into the rest of the work I've done in two ways. You know, one is that I've spent about a decade as a healthcare reporter. Actually, I started at Politico writing Pulse in 2010, about a month after the Affordable Care Act passed. And, you know, one of the things in that decade I've spent reporting on this issue that I've, you know, increasingly learned and become convinced of is that, you know, the problem in American healthcare essentially boils down to our prices being so incredibly high. You know, we're not using more healthcare than people in other countries. We're actually using less healthcare than people in Europe. If you want to understand why a fifth of our economy is going to healthcare, it essentially boils down to the fact that we are just paying more each time we go to the doctor.
And you don't think that some of that payment is worth it to get extra innovation?
I think some of it is worth it. But I think when you get to a point that people are going into bankruptcy, where you have, you know, I've written about a patient who was charged $25,000 for her daughter's MRI and the hospital just wouldn't budge on it. When you have things like that happening, then I question, you know, how much is the innovation? I agree with I think there's a pretty robust body of research suggesting when we have greater financial incentives to spend in the healthcare system, you're going to get more innovation. But I think we may have gone too far on that trade-off if Americans just don't have access to that innovation or access to less innovative products because the prices are so high. So I think it fits into, you know, the increasing interest I've had on pricing in the American healthcare system. And then it also fits into kind of the type of journalism that I like to do the most, which is, you know, connecting personal stories to policy. So you know, the podcast I host, The Impact, is all about, you know, what happens, the personal stories of policy. So looking at, you know, why, for example, everything is being sent around by fax machine in the healthcare system, which is one of my favorite stories I reported in a few years, to looking at, you know, the policy decisions that hospitals make about how they want to treat central line infections, if they're going to investigate all of them or treat them as a normal cost of doing business. And, you know, telling that through the story of a, you know, young girl who ended up dying after having four central line infections in her last year of life. So I really love telling stories that connect patients and people to these big policy things that are happening and kind of draw that pretty clearly.
There are many folks out there who love that kind of journalism, who welcome it. But there's also a constituency here in D.C., specifically the political constituency, that is not going to be as receptive to the work that you and your colleagues do as the last administration. It is not an exaggeration to say that you or Ezra could have written something on healthcare, something detailed and wonky, and President Obama could read it and tell his staff to read it. I think it is safe to say that President Trump is not reading Vox, probably not listening to The Impact. So how does your journalism change, or does it not, in this moment when the president is not a policy wonk?
So I don't think it's changed, you know, my journalism in any significant way. There are a lot of policy wonks who are still out there in state legislatures, in Congress, who still have a lot of power, who are working on things. You know, I've increasingly, it's when I was at Politico, actually, when I finished, we were just about to launch Politico Pro, and we were allowed to choose what beats we wanted. And I really wanted the states beat, because I've just been, you know, another thing that I feel like I've learned in my time reporting is that so much more happens at the state level than it does in the federal government. That federal government is constant. Ever since you had this wave of policymaking when you had unified government at the beginning of the Obama administration, there's just been constant gridlock. But states are passing so many things, and they're so interesting and experimental, and sometimes like kind of off the wall policies. So I think there's still plenty of people, you know, even if the president is not a Vox reader, there are plenty of people who are working on serious policy issues who, you know, are interested in what, you know, I and my colleagues are reporting there.
Well, readers can find more on Sarah in the show notes. They can find her podcast, The Impact. They can find her email address and send her their bills, hospital bills specifically.
Send them to, well, don't, because then our security people will get mad at me. Send them to erbills.vox.com.
Thanks for joining the podcast, Sarah.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for Pulse Check this week. My thanks to Sarah Cliff for making time for a conversation, and Micaela Rodriguez for producing the show. You can find Pulse Check on all of your favorite podcast apps. You can find links to what we talked about in the show notes. You can find me at ddiamond at politico.com. You can find a new episode of Pulse Check in your podcast player next week.